Yes, I'm Lauren Waybright. I'm very concerned about this Nicaraguan incursion, as you call it, and how we can turn that around and get the troops out of Honduras.
Turn it around and what?
Get the tide turned around. We're sending more troops down there all the time, and want to know what we can, what action might be taken, because we know what the president thinks, and we know what some of the Congress thinks, but how do we get ourselves out of that? And also encourage that peace progress that's already started.
Well, I think the honorable thing for our country to do would be to keep hands off Central America. We have disgraced ourselves. We have disgraced ourselves for more than a century by imposing dictators, crooks, and bastards on our neighbors in the name of democracy, including Somoza. So I think we ought to let the Central Americans handle it. And for once, it was a pleasure to see them getting together. But look, we undermined Duarte. We undermined Duarte. He just lost the new election in Nicaragua, in El Salvador. Don't forget that the Christian Democratic Party in El Salvador is split. Part of it is with the guerrillas. The guerrillas is a coalition of very different elements, ranging from centrist to leftist. And part of its Christian Democrats have been in power under Duarte. And I think that Nicaraguans wanted peace and saw Duarte as a chance to make peace. He had suffered under the previous dictatorship himself. And we don't like compromise. We don't like conciliation. We want to impose our will, And in my opinion, the American government thwarted and undermined the beginnings of peace talks in El Salvador, talks that had a very great possibility of success. And now the country's moving back towards civil war. And I think the Arias plan is being undermined. And this obscene business of exercises, it's a new high in official mendacity. But the good side of the question is, if you look at it in perspective, is that this is the first time, really, in American history that Central American policy has become a major topic of American political debate. When Lincoln opposed the Mexican War, he was a lonely voice in Congress. In the 20s, when many wonderful journalists, including some on the Nation, like Ernest Greening and Carlton Beals, were writing about American imperialism in Latin America and in the New York World, again, only a few intellectuals, basically, that cared. There were a few great senators that took up the cause. But today, perhaps thanks to the martyring of those poor Catholic women and the very courageous attitude taken by the Roman Catholic hierarchy and of other parts of the clergy, the country is really, and because of the Vietnam experience, because Vietnam, in a sense, was the extension of our Latin American policy across the Pacific. There again, we were supporting a landed oligarchy against the mass of a downtrodden peasantry. So if you see the reaction in Congress, for all its compromises and equivocations, it is a big improvement. And we have a better chance to And without that aroused public opinion, we might very well have been directly involved in war in Central America against Nicaragua several years ago. So I think the cause is very far from being lost, but it's certainly very precarious. And when you start intruding on a battle zone, you run the risk of American casualties and the excitement that can bring about. And I think that's one of the things the Pentagon's worried about. As far as I can see, this policy in Central America, these recent moves, have been White House and State Department moves, And the Pentagon's been a very reluctant player, and Carlucci came out quickly and said they'd get out in 10 days. There are a lot more sober minds among the military, in my opinion, than there are in the State Department or the White House, and in National Security Council. And one topic the press has completely missed the ball out is that a complete clone of Ollie North took his place in the National Security Council with no outcry in the press. There was one good story in the Washington Post about it. A man named Negroponte, a diplomat from the State Department, operated several years in 85 and 86. He was called the proconsul of Honduras in the Roman fashion, and he ran the government, and he ran the Contra operation behind the back of Congress. And then he left, and they tried to get him a nice obscure post. They put him in the law of the sea. They deep-sixed him in the law of the sea in the State Department. Then they pulled him out and gave him Ollie North's old job. And nobody's asked questions, and no congressional confirmation is required for National Security Council officials. And there he is. We don't know what he's doing. He's carrying on the same old thing. Well, I find it very hard to discuss Elliot Abrams in a mixed audience.
In a mixed audience.
Peter Wynn.
Given the nature of this occasion, I'd like to encourage you to wax philosophical.
A little bit louder.
You spent much of your life studying American democracy and the last part of your life studying Athenian democracy. What have your studies, what kind of insights have you gleaned from studying ancient Athens into American democracy, its character and its future?
Into what?
Into our democracy here and its character and its future.
Well, I think you have to beware in reading history to get those nice pat but often fallacious analogies that make such good Sunday newspaper copy. Athenian democracy was very different from American democracy. Athenian democracy was participatory. Every citizen, including the poor, this was the big thing. The poor didn't vote here until the Jacksonian period, didn't vote in most of Europe until the end of the century, the beginning of the 20th century. But in Athens, beginning with Solon, the poor, as well as the wealthier classes, sat in the assembly, made the laws, sat in the big jury carts, interpreted the laws, sat in the theater and applauded the plays they liked. It was a wonderful, and it was not representative government. It was a participatory democracy. Officials were elected for a year. They had to undergo a very strict examination of their kind of an accountant's study at the end of the year. And the theater was very democratic. If you read Bauer's wonderful introduction to the Oxford Book of Greek Verse, and it's a lovely introduction worthy of all the joys in that book, Bauer pays tribute to the democratic character of the Athenian theater, which celebrated democracy. So the two are different. Ours is a representative government. It began as a republic. It was founded by Whigs. But our Whigs, unlike the British Whigs of a century earlier, were also the children of the French Enlightenment. And Jefferson said, France is every civilized man's second country. That was a tribute to the Enlightenment. So therefore, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, is very, very different from the measly 1688 Bill of Rights in England. And it had the seeds of democracy in it. And those seeds came to fruition in the great state constitutional conventions of the 1820s and 1830s, when for the first time in modern times, people without property won the right to the franchise, at least in the North, and the right to a free public education. These were two tremendous achievements of the so-called Jacksonian period. They actually began, particularly in New York State, before the Jackson period. So the two are different, but there are many similar problems, and the picture of Socrates before the jury court has been used by anti-democratic scholars all through the ages as a black eye for democracy. This is the mob. This is the mob, typical of the mob, and they can't be trusted. This was Cicero's view and Plutarch's view, and those were the two great sources of Western Europe's knowledge of antiquity for many centuries. So I don't see any easy answers to offer you. But one of the parallels is interesting, and that is that democratic governments can be imperialistic. Athens was a democratic government and was very imperialistic. It began by organizing the defense against Persia, and then little by little, the alliance that formed and the protectorate established became an empire, just like NATO began like a protectorate and has gradually been moving in the direction of a quasi-empire. And it's a mistake to think that democratic polities cannot be imperialistic. The expansionist policies of the Democrats under from the time of Jefferson should disabuse us of that policy. And our Latin America, look at Woodrow Wilson, one of my heroes, and look at the bombing of Veracruz and his attitude toward the Mexican Revolution. For 50 years, Diaz was okay with us. That well-heeled Mexican dictator. But once the Mexicans revolted, we got very hostile to them. So I don't have any pat lessons to give you. We learn a lot from history, but it's not quite clear what we learn because we all bring our own preconceptions to it and try to find basis for them in it. You know, Marx in the 18th Brumaire, his most brilliant essay, said history is a form of politics. He didn't mean he was not advocating Stalinist style history, but what he was saying it's very obvious. But he said it succinctly, that the historians' political preconceptions are mirrored in the picture he draws of the past. And you can, there are many examples, like Macaulay's view of the Puritan Revolution, the Whig view, is very different from that of the Tory radical Hume. So I love history, and we don't understand ourselves without the past, but it's very easy to overgeneralize and over-schematize it, this business of finding lessons in it, and I don't have any really cogent ones to offer.
My name is Miriam Yevick. I'm also a charter subscriber of...
Move it louder, please.
My name is Miriam Yevick. I was also a charter subscriber of Eye of Stones Weekly. And
thank you.
I have a couple of questions. The first one is a rather personal one. I was present at your 60th birthday party, and as I recall, you said that you had just before been called by the New York Times because they were ready to write your obituary. And
she said that you had just been called by the New York Times just before your 60th birthday because they were ready to write your obituary.
And at that party, you said that you felt that you were present at your own funeral. Now, what I would like to know is, since then you have spent...
Let me answer that one first, then you take your second one.
Okay.
She hasn't answered yet.
The question is that, since then, 20 years have gone by in which you have been extremely productive and you look younger than you did at the time. So I would like to get some insight into the fountain of youth from which you have drunk.
The problem of what?
The fountain of youth. She wants some insight into the fountain of youth that you represent.
Now, I've got some things to say about the fountain of youth. First of all, you ought to get yourself a good wife or a good husband. of the Fountain of Youth. And my experience has been limited. I've only been married 59 years. but that's the first thing that... But the broader thing is this, that this is a society that has very little respect for veneration for the past or the elderly. And it's used to turning in its cars every year. And, you know, in every field of human endeavor, it's very easy to go to school and learn all the basic essentials. But learning the fine points, the nuances, the unexpected, that takes years of experience and sorrow and mishap. And people are retired much too early. And just because a man can no longer work 8 to 5 or 9 to 5 doesn't mean that he couldn't have make a real input in his old profession 3 or 4 hours a day and have some very, very cogent, useful things to say in a specific, say, I'm thinking as a newspaper man, a specific story or event. And as the population grows older of the country, I think it's an important task to keep it active and to benefit by what it has to offer. People are retired too early. And I also think that people say, you know, your memory gets worse as you get older. And there's a good deal of truth in that. But I think it's also true that like any other muscle, if it is a muscle, I don't know what it is, but if you use it, you retain it. And if you don't use it, of course it decays. I've had a wonderful time memorizing Greek poetry. And I think it's a wonderful way to get the feel of Greek, and it's very good for your memory. So I would like to see the development of some method whereby when people retire from full-time labors, they can there's a pattern and an expectation and a readiness to have them come in part-time and be called in, just the way that President Monroe called in Jefferson and Madison when to deal with Canning's proposal for what became the Monroe Doctrine, and hear what they have to say. So I think, look, some people are old at 20, and some people can be young at 60, young in spirit. Age is partly inescapable, but it has its own joys. If you're ready to accept the fact that you are not going to make the Olympics this year. You still have a lot of fun, and it's a wonderful time for learning. You know, in the Hindu tradition, in the Chinese tradition, the aged are regarded, perhaps with too much respect, as venerable. You know, can't really get to be a serious member of the Chinese Politburo till you're a lad of 80. In the Hindu tradition, after you've finished your duties as a father and a householder and a family man, you took a tin cup and went out into the world to meditate on the mysteries. And we've lost Nixon, that horror. It's always talking about innovative ideas. He never had any, really, but you just popularized the word innovative. So I think a new attitude by the elderly to themselves and by the society to the elderly could provide valuable insights in education, in journalism, in business, in many activities of life if the door was open to their cooperation. And so they were given respect and listened to in the councils of their contemporaries. I think it could be very good and very valuable. So I'd like to open that up for discussion and thought and as a contribution to the problem.
Can I ask my second question?
Yes.
Yes. Now, the second question, I guess, is actually goes directed in the other way towards the very young. As a grandmother, I of course, am suddenly very, very concerned about all the corruption and decay to which children are exposed today in the media and also, of course, in the whole direction. The whole society seems to me to be more and more falling apart in almost every respect. And there is also so much hatred in children. I mean, talking about, for instance, the Arab children, reading this article by Grossman. I mean, there is all this hatred which is being put into the young. And how do you see, I mean, talking about innovative ideas, which, how do you see the possibility of reversing the trend of our society in this direction?
Well, would you repeat that for the
everybody? Yeah, the question is has to do with the corruption of youth and both in this country and in Israel, where Grossman's recent article on what's happening to Arab youth, and how do you see reversing the trend among the young?
I don't know. Don't forget, there's a tremendous hatred among a lot of the Israeli youth for the Arabs. It's very disturbing.
I think the question was generational, not...
I know, but... I just don't know. There hasn't been a period of history in which older folks like ourselves haven't bewailed the fact that the world was going to hell. It was a part of the animosity to Socrates, I'm sure, too. I don't know. I don't know how much is real and how much is not real. I think it's been a great degeneration of education. I think a lot of the colleges are full of courses that are like fast food restaurants, junk courses. I don't think there's any great magic in Latin and Greek. If you're going to waste time on a lot of junk courses, you might as well learn some Latin and Greek. I'm not in favor of cramming it down their throats either, as the way that was crammed down, Latin was crammed down my throat in the country high school. But I just, I'm prejudiced against what the tube, the television has done to reading and to children's reading habits. This is an awfully big subject, and I just feel much the same way that you do, and I'm sorry to say I don't have an answer to it, really. I'm not even sure about the question. And I'm not sure whether we're formulating the question properly, because every question already involves answers, implies answers. So it's beyond me.
Yes.
Eugene Epstein, I'd like to ask you three questions about your views on the issue of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. First, I think it was Sidney Hook in the Wall Street Journal who, in reviewing your book, accused you of being too absolutist about Socrates' right to speak his mind. I think he said that the Athenians could have said that, in your case, we draw the line. What you say is so anti-democratic that we do have a right, at least in your case, to shut you up. Second related question, I think...
Okay, handle that first.
Sure.
I don't want to lose
yes.
it. I mean, because that's a big question. I was really surprised by Sidney Hook's remarks there, because he really began to sound like an old Stalinist to me. And I don't think he really understood what was happening in Athens. In the great funeral speech of Pericles, for example, Pericles says that if a man doesn't want to take part in his duties as a citizen, take part in the city, we regard him as an idiotes. Our word idiot, but it meant very different things in different contexts. But there, it's usually translated good for nothing. But it was his privilege. He wanted to be a private citizen and not take part in public life. That was his, so it might have been the city's loss, but it was his right. And there was lots of room for diversity in the great speech. and Solon, in establishing the laws that his laws upheld, added a right of association. And under that right of association, which the French Revolution also recognized, we don't have it in our constitution, the clubs of aristocrats that tried to manipulate elections and engaged, sometimes engaged in anti-democratic conspiracies, were never prosecuted. So that the Athenians left a lot of leeway for differences of opinion. And in Socrates' case, he has had fought bravely as a soldier for the city. He said he never took part in any of the conspiracies, and nobody ever provided evidence to the contrary. It's true that he was followed around by a lot of rich kids who drew conclusions. Socrates says in Plato's Apology, when I die, there'll be nobody to restrain them. They're going to be worse than they were before. That was kind of an admission that he knew that some of these kids were bad eggs, so to speak. But there was real freedom of speech in every aspect of Athenian life, and including religion. And I just think that Sidney Hook just, you know, Sidney Hook wrote a wonderful essay on Marxism for the Dictionary of the History of Ideas, a marvelous essay. But I don't think it, and I didn't like the, the American view is, the traditional constitutional view is that a man can only be prosecuted for overt acts and not for ideas. This was the Jeffersonian line, and that was pretty much the line in Athens. For example, people talk about impiety. It's very hard to know what was meant by impiety, because we're either Jews or Christians, and we're monotheists, and therefore anything that disturbs our God, particular Godhead, is impious. But the world of paganism was very wide open and tolerant. It wasn't pantheistic, but there was a Godhead everywhere. The hearth was a god, and the terminus, the boundary stone, not only the great gods, but little gods. Everything had its godhead. It's a wonderful, pious universe. When somebody came along with a new god, people were interested. Just like when St. Paul came to Athens, the New Testament says the Stoics and the Epicureans were interested. Who was this unknown god that took him up to the Areopagus, not for trial, but for a discussion? Nobody said anything about it. That's a real discovery of mine. The classical scholars don't read the New Testament. New Testament scholars don't pay attention to classical antiquity. But there's a continuity in Athenian history. And I want to make, oh yes, about the, for example, Euripides and the Trojan Women puts in the mouth of Hecuba, the fallen queen of Troy, a speech which any Jewish or Christian a religious court would regard as very impious. Hecuba is disgusted with the gods. She calls them cowardly allies. But then she hears a report that Menelaus has promised to beat the hell out of Helen when he gets her home. So it restores her faith in God a little bit. And she prays to God. And she says, and it's the most amazing, lofty speech. Imagine an audience that would appreciate it. And in the mouth of a fallen queen, an enemy queen, so to speak, of Troy. And she says, O chariot of the earth, O you who sit on the earth as upon a throne, whoever you may be, justa postus adonai. It means you don't fit into any of the categories of human thought. It's hard for us to know you. Two wonderful, wonderful words. And then she says, Zeus. She uses the word of Zeus. But it's a very different Zeus. She says, Zeus. Etanonke physios, whether you be the necessity implicit in nature, etanous breton, or just the mind of man, as Immanuel Kant said, the Critique of Pure Reason, I prostrate myself before you because by invisible ways you bring all mortal things to just the judgment. And Menelaus says, wow, what a newfangled prayer that is. Imagine an audience that could appreciate ideas that anticipate the unknowability of God doctrine, the doctrine of Kant and the critique of pure reason, the doctrine of the pure materialist, of necessity implicit in nature, and applauded, a very popular play. So this was really a free city as far as the mind is concerned. And it made peace with the aristocrats. Very nobly at the end of the overthrow of the 30, and again very nobly when the attempt in 401 comes apart. And I think maybe Sidney Hook was reverting to his Marxist-Leninist boyhood, or his Marxist boyhood in reading Free Speech in a way that I don't think Marx would have read Free Speech. Marx was a fellow journalist and fought the censorship, and I wish they'd reprint his articles on censorship, on the Prussian censorship in the Soviet Union today. It would give Gorbachev a big lift. So I don't understand why. I just wondered about that thing in Sidney Hook.
Second question is, I seem to recall years ago that Nat Hentoff was interviewing you on television, in which he accused you of not being absolutist enough with respect to
what?
Not being absolutist enough with respect to censorship, the right to publish pornography. I believe that you said that you were not in all cases opposed to censorship of pornography. Could you comment on that?
Well, I don't know. You know, there's a great legal maxim that says hard cases make bad law. I'm very dubious about censorship of so-called pornography because I think action was brought against Flaubert after Madame Bovary. And James Joyce got in trouble with Ulysses. And the standards of what we will take in literature and art have changed a great deal in the past a century. So I'm leery about the enemies of free speech. Khrushchev, when he was over here, picked on American pornography as an example of free speech, disregarding the broader aspects of it. But really, the lengths to which people are hustling sadomasochism and abuse of children, and it's just dreadful. And there's a lot of good conservative church people that are very disturbed by it. I'm disturbed by it too. And I don't know what the answer is, but I certainly hate to see this. Look, it's always been there. Look, young Talmudic scholars search out little parts of the Bible that are sexually titillating. And in my generation, too, we read pornography behind the barn, so to speak. But it's commercialization, and it's extremism, and it's one thing to see the beauties of the naked human body that the Greeks love, but my God, some of the stuff is just disgusting.
Final question about freedom of speech. There are absolutists like Nat Hentoff and I believe Noam Chomsky who have publicly declared, when asked, that they would never under any circumstances sue anybody for libeling their good name. But of course, many people have done so. What is your stand on that issue?
What about libel?
On libel.
Well, look, Hentoff may be right, and I'm just talking about my kvetches. But about libel, I think American libel law makes a very good distinction between private and public persons. If a man committed a crime in his youth and then paid for it and led a decent life afterwards, and why should that be printed to his shame? That should be actionable as defamation or slander or libel, depending on the form it takes. And American law does allow that type of action. But when a man is running for public office, we encourage the utmost freedom of examination. And you can't have freedom without its abuse. There's no way to have freedom without its abuse. So very often the attacks on public men are very unfair or even wrong. And I don't think it's the job of journalists to defame people. It's the job of journalists to provide understanding. But see, in the old English common law, if you said something truthful that was damaging to the king, that was even more actionable if you said something untruthful. In the eyes of the older common law, if it was really true, you really ought to be punished because it really did damage the king. Now, we got away from the English common law, thank heavens, in America, and early in the 19th century, it was declared not part of our, necessarily part of our law. So I think that, see, there are no absolutes anywhere. See, it's good to couch certain things as absolutes. And the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, press, or assembly. But the question came up very early, well, what about suits for libel or slander? And the first answer was, well, that was done by the state governments, and they were unaffected by the Congress. And then later on, when the 14th Amendment was read to incorporate the First Amendment, and when Charles Evans Hughes, in a very, very great decision in Near versus Minnesota, upholding the freedom of the press of a dirty, blackmailing, lousy Minnesota weekly, and a disgrace to journalism, nevertheless, he upheld it, and he upheld freedom of the speech, freedom of the press, a very noble and great decision and a very bad case. And I think that's a good guide, and maybe Hentoff and Chomsky are right. And I'm not calling for censorship, but I'm just a bit queasy about the disgusting and mass commercialization of all kinds of sadistic masochistic horrors.
Final question, what is your next... What is your next major project? What is your next major project?
I think the view of the assembly is that you have already had your fair share of questions.
So, summarize the answer to the last one. You're not endorsing the old English principle, then uprose Lord Mansfield, he spake like the Bible, the greater the truth, sir, the greater the libel.
Say that again?
Well, I'll tell you later. We have another questioner over here.
My name is Elliot Loschak, and I'm a one-time philosophy major.
It's like me.
As all Platonic scholars know, no evil can befall a good man. And we love you, Izzy, and no evil can ever befall you. In your book, there's a tantalizing reference, tantalizing to me anyway, to Professor Alan Bloom, to the effect that he thinks Plato was satirizing his own vision of his utopia by suggesting in the Republic that the leader, that is the one who knows, could improve the herd, his people, by thinning out the herd. That is to say, accelerated natural selection, like in Sparta, where the infants were subjected to physical hardships to ensure that only the fittest would survive. A kind of a modest proposal 2,000 years before Swift. It's tantalizing for two reasons. First is that Professor Bloom's rationale is very similar to the views of my own philosophical guru, with whom I studied at college.
Who is that?
His name is Phil Stanley.
Phil what?
Philip Stanley.
Yeah. Yeah.
We saw Plato as essentially a dramatist.
Essentially what?
A dramatist.
Yeah.
And Socrates as a tragicomic actor who was kidding, pretending, posturing, shifting ground, changing form, like Proteus, with whom he compared himself, for only one reason, ultimately, to prod the reader audience to think and to understand his own limitations and ignorance, to sting, like his famous gadfly, but for the purpose of stimulating, not hurting, even though sometimes thinking hurts. That, incidentally, would account for Socrates' dislike of the sophists. Their teaching was essentially indoctrination.
That's all right. Let him have his say. No.
Well, my question is, would you... I really have two questions. First of all, the characterization of Plato as essentially a dramatist and Socrates as an actor, which would suggest that the substance of their ideas is secondary to the process of their performance. Would you agree with that, or would you dissent from it strongly? The second question has to do with, I see Bloom reading Socrates just as you do, that is to say, elitist, authoritarian, private rather than political. Bloom, if I'm not mistaken, says that the desertion of those ideas or the flight from them is what has caused the modern university to fail the modern student. And I was wondering if you would comment on both those things.
Well, he asked a big question there. The difficulty about Bloom's theory of the Republic as a satire on utopianism, which he got from his teacher, Leo Strauss, it might be a viable hypothesis if it weren't for the fact that all four of the Platonic utopias, the Politicus, the Laws, and the Timaeus Critias, are all more or less totalitarian. He couldn't have spent his whole lifetime, Plato couldn't have spent his whole lifetime kidding himself. And Leo Strauss didn't draw pro-democratic conclusions from his theory. In fact, in Germany, before he left in 1932, there's a new Rutgers University publication of something by a German philosopher named Schmidt, who might just as well have been left in obscurity, who became a pet of the Nazis. And in the book, there's a review that Leo Strauss wrote. Now, Strauss was a great scholar, both a great Jewish scholar and a great classical scholar. I don't like his views. He's very right-wing, very reactionary. But he was a great scholar, and he was beloved by a lot of his pupils. But in this essay, in 1932, a German Jew in Germany spent all his time talking about the great menace of what to Germany? Liberalism. Believe it or not, Meshuggah tight.
Translation?
Well, completely nutty. It's not classical Greek, it's classical Yiddish. Now about this other thing you bring up. You see, Olympiodorus says, with an ancient biographer, that Plato wanted to be a playwright. But when he met Socrates, he tore up his plays. It's a charming story, and I think there may be something to it. Plato did combine playwriting with philosophy. He's the only philosopher who ever turned metaphysics into dramaturgy. And that's part of his charm and part of the fact that he's read and reread, because the trial and death of Socrates is one of the great Greek tragedies. And Socrates, to some extent, is his tragic hero. And I would never say anything to mar the beauty of that performance. And to some degree, he is Plato's creation, but only to some degree. You don't forget that other schools of philosophy emerged from the Socratic circle. He had a very wide influence. His views were interpreted differently by different disciples. For example, all the Socratic dialogues written by Antisthenes, who was really a nominalist and anti-idealist, were destroyed. And we don't know how he interpreted Socrates. There's a great German scholar named Schleiermacher, 19th century, and when he had to deal with the problem of the historical Socrates, he said the way to deal with it was to take Xenophon's Socrates, Plato's Socrates, and Aristotle's. And where all three agreed on a characteristic, there was a pretty high degree of probability that that was the historical Socrates. Now, I would add to that the testimony of the of Aristophanes and other comic poets, and that's one reason I don't attribute to Socrates in my book the wilder nuttiness of Plato's Republic, like the community of wives and children, because I find no evidence elsewhere or in the comic poets who have had a lot of fun with it of Socrates being in favor of any such ideas. So Socrates was not, you see, he opened up the problem of definition. It's a very important, Aristotle gives him credit for that. It's very important to define what you're talking about, because so often in controversy, people talk about two different things. And the definition was the basis of the syllogism. And from the definition, you infer, you know, men are two-legged, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates had two legs. You infer your conclusion. But there's no absolute definition. Some men are born without legs. Are they not men? It was Helen Keller, not a human being because she couldn't hear or speak. So by carrying his thing too far toward the, and claiming that the only real knowledge was an absolute definition, and then admitting that he himself didn't have it, and that nobody knew anything, and he was superior because he knew he didn't know anything, he left people up a blind alley. And he created a complete skeptic, and Antisthenes, and indeed in the Platonic family, because within about a century of the death of Plato, the second Platonic Academy went skeptical, and the third Platonic Academy under Carneades went super skeptical, because you didn't answer the problem of knowledge by putting models up in the sky and saying that was the only reality. I mean, that's what Bacon called one of the idols of the mind, making things out of concepts. Now, in general, the concepts are very important, but to make things out of them and make them the only reality was nonsensical, and there was a strong reaction against that. Now, I've been accused of being hostile to philosophy because I'm hostile to idealistic metaphysics. I resent the identification of philosophy purely with idealistic metaphysics. Many other great philosophers have not been idealists, and there's been a continuous debate through the ages, or all the way down through Bacon and William James and Popper of this problem. And Plato may not be entirely wrong either. There are pages in the history of science where a priori propositions have been fruitful scientifically. I don't know enough about it, but there are such things where inferences from the a priori have opened up new doors. So sometimes it may work. I don't know, and so it isn't a question of right or wrong or either or. It's a question that so often, when philosophers take a very valid and wonderful lightning flash of insight and then schematize it, it becomes nonsensical. Like when Heraclitus said, you can't step in the same river twice, it was true in one sense. The waters change, the banks change. In one sense, it's true. Another sense, it's not true. If you look at history, the Ganges is where it always has been. The Amazon is where it always has been. The Mississippi flows where it's flowed for centuries. So you have two mysteries. You have the mystery of flux, eternal change, and then you have the mystery of identity. You see a baby, and he changes as he becomes a man or a woman, and then old age. But you often catch the old traits in the face, in the mind, in the spirit. So we have the wonderful mystery of perpetual change, and we have the wonderful mystery of identity, and much of philosophy is the contemplation of these mysteries to which no absolute answer and final answer is possible. And I think that's the way to look at Plato and Socrates. Is he, but not just the play, though. There's serious issues there, too.
If I were a poet or a good editor, I'd stop it right there, because that's a beautiful statement. But we have a couple of people who have questions. We're getting close to 10 o'clock, so I'm going to take this gentleman, that woman, and then we'll call it a night, I think.
So. Hello, Mr. Stone. My name is Mark Holder, and I'm a student at the Columbia. My name is Mark Holder, and I'm a student at the Graduate School of Journalism, Columbia University. I also spent some time in political theory, and I admire your work tremendously.
In where?
In McGill University.
Political theory at McGill, is
it? Oh.
Okay, now I'd like to draw your attention to the beginning of your book, to the first couple of chapters, where you come out and you say, for lack of a better word, you attack Socrates, and you say, you ask a rhetorical question, you ask, the city of Milos and Miletini, excuse my pronunciation if I'm incorrect, why didn't Socrates, why didn't he come out and say something in the Athenian resemblance of a hall, a great hall of debate? Why didn't he come there and come out and condemn the Athenian actions in Milos and their willingness to do the same in Miletine? Why didn't he do that if he was a virtuous man in search of virtue?
And the gadfly.
And the gadfly, that whole stinging business. Right. So my question to you now is, the reason, well, it's a statement, and then I'd like your response. I believe that he did not believe in democracy. That's why he didn't come to the Great Hall. He was opposed to democracy. He was in favor of oligarchy. That's the reason why he didn't come out and say anything. He remained silent. I'd like your response.
Well, I think you're right. He didn't believe in democracy. That's why he didn't. Then why should he call himself the gadfly of Athens, plugging a sluggish horse? And I use Milos and Mytilene because in Milos, Athens committed a great crime against the people of Milos. In Mytilene, they were about to do it again, and a brave unknown man spoke up in the assembly, got them to reverse themselves, sent out the ships, withdrew the orders, and saved people of Mytilene from a massacre. Why wouldn't it have been virtue and noble for Socrates to speak up? He had a duty to the city. And I feel badly that he didn't even on some such great occasion raise his voice. He was going around talking about virtue, and he didn't have any definition, and he just aborted. He wasn't a midwife, he was an abortionist. He aborted everybody else's definition. He left everybody up a tree, the way Meno says in the Plato's dialogue of that name. Look, Meno says, I've been talking about virtue and very satisfactorily, and then you just numb me like the torch fish. You numb people. Obviously, when Socrates talked about virtue, they knew he wasn't talking about shoemaking or horse trading. They meant good people and bad people. Everybody knew what virtue was. So when he began to finesse and finagle about a perfect definition of virtue, he just got everybody confused. He wasn't a teacher of ethics at all. He wasn't teaching any ethics. Well, there's only one ethical thing there, and that is that people don't do evil voluntarily. That's nonsense. But lots of times, crooks and criminals are superior people. They know damn well what they're doing. Francis Bacon was a great philosopher, Lord Chancellor of England, and he took bribes. He knew damn well what he was doing, and he apologized for it and suffered for it. He knew. Alcibiades knew. He was a gifted genius. He knew what he was doing wrong. So you're right when saying that Socrates didn't turn up because he had contempt for the democracy. So why would he call himself a gadfly? What was the good of a gadfly that didn't sting the horse when it needed? That's the only point I made.
Yeah, I agree with that point. I was just wondering if he wasn't trapped in some sort of a contradiction himself. On the one hand, if I do participate and I do speak out in opposition to the Athenians and their activities in Milos and Mytilene, then I am in fact participating in the democracy, which is something I strongly condemn.
Well, that's pretty. I think there's a lot of what you say, but he never dared to say that position openly. Look, unlike the sophists that he condemned, because aristocrats hated the sophists because they were teachers for the rising middle class. There were sophists that attacked slavery in the 5th century, as Euripides did, and the evils of war. There's no attack on war or slavery anywhere in the Socratic or Platonic canon. It's taken for granted. First the sophists and then the Stoics broke new ground in this respect. The Socratic and Platonic ethics are very conventional and very overrated by scholars who read Plato the way theologians read the Bible. Everything is sacred writ, holy writ, and ooh and ah, and you mustn't question it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Sidney Shapiro. I'm a neighbor. I consider myself a contemporary, if not a peer, of I.F. Stone. Up until a quarter of
You're
eight.
Bragging about your youth, huh?
We're fellow youth. I have the pretentious title of scholar in residence of the Public Employees Federation, but I have been saving a clipping from December 15th, the op-ed article that you wrote twitting Gorbachev on intellectuals, and you referred to a mass of indigestible dough. Indigestible dough, if it didn't have leaven. Gorbachev had referred to the intellectuals as a leaven.
Yes, the yeast.
And yes, right, yeast. Yeah. That was the title of the op-ed piece.
Right.
And then my idol fell. He chose an unfortunate metaphor, indigestible mass of dough. Well, I've enclosed to a young woman here.
He didn't say that, but Gorbachev.
No, you said it.
I said that.
Right. That's what bothered me.
Huh?
You said it. So I had brought to the meeting tonight, but a young woman who took it, she was going to give it to you, a copy of your op-ed article and a side of a box of matzahs.
Ah, good. Very good.
Because my grievance is not with you, but with the matzah industry in the slack season, you see.
But the matzahs were produced under very adverse circumstances.
Yes, but flour and water and no leaven.
In the desert. And
17 minutes on the clock.
And it's not the greatest delicacy, though.
A matzah brine.
The only point I was making was that since Gorbachev said in that wonderful metaphor,
I understood your point.
That the intellectuals at that audience should have asked him some pretty tough questions.
Yeah, but my Izzy Stone picked what I called an unfortunate metaphor. I was afraid of sending it to the Nation, lest Alec Coburn pick it up.
But you're quite right. I apologize to the matzah industry. And I will eat my fried matzahs and Pesach with new relish as a result of your interpolation.
So,
Florence Volkmann Pincus, as also a philosophy major and political activist for well over half a century, I much appreciate the symmetry and balance of this meeting, because we began with Victor Navasky talking about the political campaign, and we had the very rich kind of philosophic aspects in between, with some peripheral references here and there to politics. And I would like to bring it back to politics, particularly since most of us in this audience, I am sure, going to be voting in the primaries in a couple of weeks. And I would like to ask you, Mr. Stone, about your reference to Jesse Jackson. And I'd like you to elaborate on what you said, because I believe that we are all in danger of what I consider to be another kind of phenomenon of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I'll explain what I mean. When we think about Jackson as a candidate, and the reason that I'm talking about him is that you felt that he was the most interesting, and certainly the American people, in terms of the Democratic primaries, are also agreeing with that. And if he won in Alaska, he can't be just an Hispanic and Black candidate. And I feel that when we talk about him, as you referred, that really, but he can't win because we're not prepared in terms of our racism, I think that can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what can happen is that we can feel, so many of us, when we go to the polls, well, we might like to vote for him, but at the same time, after all, if he's not going to win, then we don't want a Republican to win, so therefore we'll vote for what we might consider to be a lesser Democratic candidate. And I feel that this would be a great mistake. Also, if we consider him to be a good candidate. Also, when we talk about racism, and that in 8 years we'll be somewhat less racist and therefore ready, I think that we're overlooking the fact that behavioral changes, behavioral phenomena, bring about changes in racism in the same way that if we consider the Jackson campaign, as he went on week after week, winning more delegates, there was more respect for him. And therefore, I hope, and I don't want to be foolhardy about this, that there was, I'm not trying to be overly sanguine, because I'm not. I believe that we have to recognize the realities of the situation, but at the same time, as there are phenomena that are going on that change people's opinions, when Jackson has been winning more, there's more respect for him and perhaps for the blacks, and certainly if we can have a black president, then that is going to help to change racism perhaps before 8 years are up.
The question is, could you comment on that statement?
Yes, I'd like to know your feelings.
Look, I think it's a very eloquent, cogent statement of the case against what you call self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's something we all have to consider. But unfortunately, the choices are very short-range choices, and you're caught between wanting to see him get as big a vote as possible and the evidence that maybe he has 10% white support or 15% at the most. And on the other hand, there's a lot of racism in our country, and a lot of people would switch to the Republicans precisely on the race issue to vote against the black president. It's a very tough decision. And I think you've stated the case very well for your point of view. But I'm just stating the doubts that many thoughtful people feel about this very difficult question.
I think, for everybody here, Izzy, when I say that no one expected to go from Aristotle and Plato to Matzah Brei in one evening, and we're very grateful to you for sharing this.